The Buddhist words on loving kindness. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as her mother protects with her life her child, her only child. So with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outward and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world.
Sad.
So, when we come to the practice, we have to face our own defilements, which means we need to look in the mirror. Regularly. And to face our own defilements, I mean, to begin with, usually it's about developing mindfulness, developing peace, and learning to be aware of our actions. Now, so our actions are when we move the body, when we speak, and when we think. That means, believe it or not, even our emotions are within our control. So this world seems to be largely run on emotion at the moment, but you know, that's not healthy to let external forces look after our minds for us. So we need to be responsible for our own minds, be responsible for our own actions. You know, if we get ill, we want to, back at the time of the Buddha for the monks, if somebody hasn't offered us a medicine, I mean, the only medicine we can ask for is fermented cow's urine, because that was like the poor people's medicine of the day, basically ammonia, enough to shock your immune system, to force you to get better, because you don't want to drink it again. And I think the other one that we're allowed is if nobody's around and you get bitten by a snake, you're allowed to mix dung with dirt and eat it. Because that's another thing to shock your immune system, because usually the poison will slowly kill you. But if you do something like that, you aggressively wake up your immune system and it might actually prevent you from dying. So they're like the kind of medicines that we're allowed if nobody's offered them. But then when you look at the mind, the Buddha said that unless you're enlightened, you're mentally ill. So just remind yourself, whoever we're talking to through our days and when we're looking in the mirror, that we're all mentally ill. Means we still have work to do. And so what came up just where I was sitting down was, it's like being a Dharma warrior. So we need to learn to be a warrior for truth. And the only way we can do that is if we learn what is truthful. And, you know, what is in line with the Dhamma. So the word Dhamma means truth, but also means like law. It's like the natural law of things. And so when a Buddha becomes a Buddha, they wake up to a complete understanding of the workings of the whole universe and of all actions. And so they can see the cause and effect of actions. But then out of all of that, the only things that a Buddha speaks about are those things that are useful to help humans get out of suffering. So if we're not Buddhist yet, then maybe we just want to learn to be good at our trade or be good with our families or be a good leader. And the Buddha, people would come to him and the Buddha would teach them how to do that. But then if you were a disciple of the Lord Buddha, then he would teach you about ending suffering in your own heart, about learning from your own experience. And usually, the first teaching he would start with is generosity, because that's one thing that as this generation, as the Buddhist generation, is obsessed with the stain of miserliness. That's what the Buddha said. We're obsessed with holding on to our own things and not giving anything away. And why I was very fortunate in this life that I've always been generous, probably too generous, particularly with other people's things. But because of that generosity, when I came to Buddhism, it was very easy for me to practice a lot, because when you're generous, it's very close to being thankful and grateful. You know, when you give a lot, you know, you give within your means, but if you're always willing to give and help other people, then you're on that kind of edge which is very close to thankfulness and gratefulness. And the Buddha said that a mark of a true person is somebody who's thankful and grateful. Know how to count your blessings. Know how to look for the good things in your life. The world's ending and you're like, well, it's a good day today. I didn't do any of my bad things. So it's like whatever our defilements are, you know, that's in our own hearts. So if we're angry, then, you know, when you don't get angry at your neighbor for whatever they usually do that annoys you, then that's a good action, you know. So it's like, it might be something small to somebody else, but to us, I remember talking to a friend of mine once, and they were talking really heavily about how bad their neighbor was. And so I tried in the conversation to just explain that they were another human being and, you know, they had their own issues and stuff. And by the end of the conversation, I think he actually got it, you know. And it's just, what we do is we project. You know, if it wasn't our neighbor, it would be a politician. If it wasn't a politician, it would be one of our children or our husband or our wife. We're always projecting our defilements onto other people. And it doesn't mean that other people shouldn't be responsible for their actions, but we first have to look at ourselves. And then, so the Buddha, then after the generosity, which, you know, he said giving to like the monks and nuns, because the good thing about giving to the monks and nuns is you're partaking in their practice. So if it's a good monk or a nun and they're practicing for nibbana, you get some of the merits of that. You know, you might give them a pair of sandals or feed them one day or offer some robes to them. And then every time they're using that, you're getting good karma from that. And if they're not yet a good monk or nun, maybe one day they will be. Or maybe one day they'll be enlightened. So you're helping them in that period where they haven't yet figured themselves out. And so that's why, and if it wasn't for generous people, there wouldn't be any Sangha. The Buddha would have never become enlightened. And I say everything is resting on generosity. So if it wasn't for generosity, there would be no Buddhism. So it's a very important point. And why I like generosity is it's very close to renunciation. You know, if you're willing to renounce your own time and generosity, yes, interesting. It's like the Westerners, they're quite interested in meditation, but not so interested in the generosity. And those from the East are interested in the generosity, but not so interested in the meditation. But the two have got to go together. Because the meditation is what will help us deal with our defilements. And the generosity is what will help us renounce our commitment to holding on to things. And then once we have this generosity, and then it's easier to keep the precepts. So there's the five precepts and the eight precepts, and the usual thing for lay people. And so the five precepts, you just investigate them. So if somebody doesn't yet do them, well, you just see which ones you are doing and start with that. So, you know, if you're only doing three of the five precepts, and start with that. And then look into your life at the results of not doing the other ones. You know, like in Australia, there's, you know, drinking is a very big culture. But where does going to the pub, where does drinking lead one? Does one have mindfulness after one has a drink? Or does it actually open one up to breaking all the other precepts? So even though these things might have a temporary pleasure, we have to look at the other side of it. We have to investigate and see what is the result of it. And I noticed when I first became a Buddhist that when I drank, I was far less inclined to want to meditate that week. So there's something to do with having a bright mind. It's very different to drugs and alcohol. And so one is kind of like a form of escapism, a cheap form of happiness. Or is it chicken shit to gold? You could compare it. And by these things, we have to learn through our own experience. Nobody can learn it for us. So it's not that we blindly believe, but you just take it on board. And you say, well, it might be true, it might not be true. And whether it takes us 1 year, 3 years, or 5 years, we continually investigate and follow up until we know it for ourselves, which is true. You know, is it true or is it not true that this brings us suffering? And then same with sexual misconduct, you know, if you've got a partner or something, you can even bring it into your mind where you get to the point where you wouldn't even have sexual thought of misconduct. You know, so the precepts aren't necessarily just in the physical form. They can be taken to a much more refined level. And the purpose of that is, and then you're not having to, you know, lots of people in this world get stuck on sexuality. So you can just cut out a lot of the fantasy. Focus on living, being a good person, and then let those things have their right time and place. And then I think because we have a culture of entertainment, that people get lax with the responsibility over their own minds. But the good thing about having reins over our minds is that then when we come to meditate and then when we're doing good, we can actually gain benefit from those things. Because otherwise our minds are just like you know, a bit of driftwood in the ocean that's just going in any direction. But when we're practicing the Dharma, it's very much headed in a particular direction. You know, we know where we're going and it has a purpose. And so every little bit of restraint, depending on our personality, will help to lead us in the right direction. And then, of course, the third section is bhavana. And it's interesting the Buddha chose that word for lay people. For monks, it's samadhi. But for lay people, it's bhavana. I think the reason is because, you know, household life is dusty and crowded, you know. You've got cobwebs, you've got children, dogs. Lots of things to busy your life. So how do you, and unless you're an experienced meditator, even if you're an experienced meditator, you get caught up in these things. So the idea is that you watch your mind, you develop your mind. So in any part of the day, do we have wholesome mental states? Are we developing good things? You know, you're washing the dishes, you're going for a walk, you're opening a car door, you're talking to a family member. What are your mental states? And what are we developing? And so that's like bhavana. And so the Buddhism or the Dharma is like the law of the mind. So we, it's not that we need a lot of things, but just like the 10 wholesome and unwholesome courses of action. You know, they have the precepts in there, but then they go into the mind, like giving up covetedness, giving up hatred, giving up wrong views, you know. So this is the part where we need to know a little bit of Dharma. But then if we have right views, you know, we know, like the worldly version of right view actually starts with giving. There is what is given, there is what is offered. There is mother and father, there is ascetic and Brahman. And, you know, there is the heavenly realm and the hell realms. That means we understand that the universe is that it is and karma is a force. If we know karma is a force, then that gives us a reason to practice, because we don't want to go to hell. You know, even if we get a really good life and then we become a wheel-turning monarch, if we get it wrong and we send a few people to get their heads chopped off, then when we die, we might have to go to hell for a little bit to pay for that. So even the people with the best intention, when they're stuck in this round of samsara, if they have even a little bit of wrong action, once you get into a very high position, that can be devastating. And so, actually, there's a Jataka tale when this happened to the Buddha. So this is like the past lives of the Buddha. And in one life, he was a king, and he did just that. And he had these people executed. And then when he died, he went to hell for a little bit before he went to heaven. And then in his next life, he was born as a son of a king. And then, but he was born with these memories of this past life, of being in hell. And so here he is as this little child thinking, what the heck am I going to do? I don't want to go to hell again. And this Deva, I think, came to him and said, well, you know, just pretend to be dumb, you know, like don't talk, don't speak, just, you know, pretend to be basically disabled. So the Buddha thought that was a good idea, or Buddha to be. And then by the age of 20, you know, the parents had tried everything. They thought he was faking, but they couldn't prove it. So then they went and had him dumped in dumped to be killed somewhere. And then the moment that the person took him out there, he said, well, okay, well, now you're going to dump me. I'll go off and I'll become a monk. So you could say you were going to kill me anyway. So that was his like ticket out of, you know, having to be a king in that life. But the purpose of that story is to just say that even the Buddha was wary of, you know, being a king, because, you know, one wrong action as a king can be devastating karma. And so then when we look at our own lives, we can't be complacent with our lives. You know, every day we're closer to death. And we don't know when it's going to come. It could come tonight. My father once, he was a volunteer ambulance driver, and he went out to a man got impaled by a branch falling from a tree when he was driving home one night. So I mean, it's a pretty gruesome way to die. But I mean, we just never know. You know, it could be something totally random. And I don't believe in karma in a sense that, you know, everything is karma. The Buddha usually said there were several things involved, you know. So karma is just one of them. So if somebody gets sick and dies, it's not because of their karma. Their karma is a part of it, but there's only certain karma which is actually caused. Like if you were a doctor and did something malicious to one of your patients, then maybe in another life, you know, you have to experience that. You know, that would be like a direct form of karma. But usually it's a mixture of different things. And so then when we come back to the bhavana, it's like, I think bhava is just learning to watch over the mind, you know. So it's like a more, where samadhi is developing the kind of the stillness and the investigation on a much deeper level. The bhavana is the ability to develop wholesome states and know where your mind is. And so the Buddha chose that because it's hard as a layperson to develop meditation. So we just have to do what we can each day to develop the mind. And And it's like a soldier, you know, a soldier doesn't become a soldier in one day. They train, you know, and then they learn strategy. And particularly if they're like a general or something, and they have to study the art of war. And then, you know, a lot of wars by clever people are won without doing much at all, because they know how to strategize, you know. So if we don't know our own defilements, if we don't know how to meditate, how to develop bhavana, if we don't know what right view is, if we don't know what the Four Noble Truths are, if we don't know how to watch the mind, then things are going to be difficult for us. But if we know, you know, how to meditate, we know a bit of Dhamma, then, you know, that's enough. And then we just got to really purify the mind. It's like there was a disciple of the Buddha who wasn't particularly intelligent, and the Buddha just gave him a rag and said, clean with this. And just him rubbing with this rag was enough for him to reflect back on himself and see that it was like having to clean your own mind. You know, that's what the Buddha was saying. So even if you've got a rag, just that idea of rubbing and rubbing and rubbing. It's like when you go to a monastery and you sweep the monastery. Next day you've got to sweep it again. Next day you've got to sweep it again. It's like our defilements, you know. Every day we've got to do the same thing to take those defilements out of the mind. And if somebody's not used to doing this, what I suggest to do, when I first learned, is just start with your worst one. Like write all your defilements down on a page, and then choose the number one defilement that's your absolute worst, and doesn't even compare to anything else. And then commit that that's going to be the one thing that you never do. And then at least then you have mindfulness, because you know every day you're never going to allow this thing to arise, and you're going to attack it any time you see it. And that's really a good kind of first step into having kind of mindfulness, because at least you've started with something, you know, and then that gives you a sense of accomplishment, and then you can, you know, learn more of your defilements and strategize further. And then the meditation is useful, because the meditation allows us to develop a peaceful mind. When we have a peaceful mind, then, you know, it's like the eye of the storm or the Himalayan mountain. It doesn't matter what's happening outside. You know? It doesn't matter if the world is ending. We're just there with our meditation object. I mean, we're going to die one day anyway. And the other thing is that metta, whenever you meditate, really, if you're meditating correctly, there's a bit of metta there, because you're not going out and doing any harm to anybody. You know, you have a sense of goodwill to other people. And so, you know, these Brahmaviharas are very healing, and they actually beautify a person, because what happens is you start to be able to forgive people without even doing anything. You know, and then suddenly you see that other people, they're just in a bundle of conditions like us, making decisions. You know, there's no reason to be angry and upset at them. But we should learn to associate with people who are wise, so we can become wise. If we always associate with fools, how's that going to end up? There's another Jataka tale where the Buddha is saying, actually, if you have one of your children, for example, if they weren't keeping the precepts, then you should actually treat them like an outsider. Meaning that you would feed them, clothe them, give them a roof over their head, but you'd be very careful not trusting things with them. Because somebody who drinks and gambles and so on, they're going to lead people to ruin. So it doesn't mean you don't respect them and look after them, but you don't associate with them in that way, because otherwise they can lead you to ruin. And that's something that I see our society is deeply missing at the moment, that we just think that we should just trust everybody. But unless we know those people personally, then we should never invest blind trust in anybody. You know, so that's why you always start with your family and people in your business. You should always know who they are and know their personalities and understand people. So our trust is actually based on reason. It's not blind. We've all seen the devastation of people with blind faith in religion. So blind faith in humanity is very similar. And so that's where we learn. It's not that we cut people out, but if you went and let this person look after your business, well, they could go and gamble it all away. And wouldn't you be upset after that? And didn't you do it to yourself? So that's why we need to be circumspect with our actions. And it's not that we're cutting those people off, because, you know, you're giving them food and you're giving them these things, but you're just drawing a line in your life saying that I'm going to associate with people who keep the precepts, you know, because that's going to make it easier for me to keep the precepts. And these are the things that keep people out of hell, you know, because if you don't keep the precepts, then one life you get angry at your husband or your wife, you might kill them. And then where are you going to end up? You might go back to the animal realm. It's very hard to get out of. And so the reason the Buddha, actually, yeah, I've told it before, the story of Sakka's wife. So Sakka, the kind of the ruler of the Devas, in his previous life as a human, he did many good acts, and so did the people around him, but his wife didn't. His wife just kind of sat on her laurels that life and didn't really do any good at all. And then so when she died, they all got reborn in the heavenly realm, and she got reborn as a bird. And then Sakka went down out of pity to her and taught her the five precepts. And then because she was a bird and she couldn't kill any fish, she actually died within a few days. That was her restraint. She actually took to heart. And then she was reborn as a human, and Sakka went and visited her again. And so even though the Dharma wasn't in that period of time, she was born knowing what the five precepts were. So she was going around saying, I keep the five precepts, even though that wasn't like a common thing at the time. And so that's the idea, that this becomes a part of our mind, that even if we die, you know, we're going to carry these things with us. And then by her third life, she was reborn as a yaka, which is like a lower god. And then Sakka went down and managed to regain her as his wife again. So now they're kind of back together in heaven. And the Buddha really praised Sakka because he stuck to his convictions. You know, he just had a few rules in his life that he lived by, but he kept them so well, unfailingly, that he ended up being reborn as Sakka. And as Sakka said, to be able to have 10,000 thoughts at once. So I think in Hinduism it's Indriya, you're probably more familiar with. And the reason the Buddha gives us these stories is because they show us that karma and vipaka is true, cause and effect is true. So if we're not yet a Sotapanna, if we're not yet fully a disciple of the Buddha, striving for nibbana, then we should at least try and get a foothold in these five precepts. These are things that are going to protect us. You know, we can't take our TV with us, but we can take our karma with us. You know, and our karma burns out, and so we need to continually learn to do good. So if we create a mind that's focused on generosity, focused on being thankful and grateful, counting our blessings, that is wise, that knows right view, that knows when people are doing right action and wrong action, so we can associate with the wise, then we're gonna be like a train going in the right direction, not the wrong direction. You know, we're not going off a cliff. So that's the idea of bhavana, is that we have this momentum in the correct direction, and that's why I think the Buddha gave that for lay people. It's the three really go together. When you're generous, then you, by default, you have some restraint, you know, because you have to give up other things, pleasures which may have come easily, you have to say no to them, you know. Or like just say not lying, you know. Sometimes it's really difficult not to lie because you're in a situation where you're in pressure, and then you've got to make the decision that you're going to put yourself through suffering for the sake of telling the truth rather than an easy way out. And so these things, until we train in them, and my first teacher, made the analogy, it's like saving for a rainy day. You know, so when we meditate and we come to talks like this, what I did when I first started meditating is I would have a half an hour meditation or so, 20 minutes, and then I would journal for 20 minutes. And so I'd actually write down, like, afterwards and trying to put my life in the right direction. Because of TVs and things, I don't think most of us use our mind very much. So I found a journal a very useful way of kind of helping me with that. And then that's like saving for the rainy day. So then when you come in that situation, if you were if you were used to lying a lot in the past, then it's going to take you a while to decondition that. You know, or if you were somebody who had sexual misconduct, then, you know, you need to look at what are the causes of that. So that's why the three really go together, because as we get the brightness from the generosity, then it's easier for us to keep the precepts and understand the precepts, and then from the precepts it's easier for us to develop the mind. And eventually when they all kind of come together, then it's like the mind is luminous. Like that's the blamelessness. So the Buddha said the purpose of the precepts, if there was another way, he said he would have found it, but there is no other way. So that's like the foundation for the mind. And why we want to make that super strong is when it crumbles, it's just going to bring us lots of suffering. So we need to make sure that that's like, they're like pillars in our lives. And then the other option is then on a weekend day or on a moon observance day to do the eight precepts, where we give up like entertainment and high beds and perfumes and singing and dancing and television and all that stuff. And so you have like a day which is more spiritual. And the reason the Buddha encouraged that is actually a lay person who regularly keeps the eight precepts, like once a week or something, that's enough to be reborn in heaven. Like that's that level of renunciation. That's what it will do. And it's not that the Buddha was encouraging people to go to heaven only, you know, he's encouraging people to come enlightened. But it's certainly much better going to heaven than it is becoming an animal. So it's like, it's taking us in the right direction. And these things are possible, you know. I think that's why when we investigate the suffering in our lives, and then we see that these precepts, they're a way of keeping us away from suffering. And then once we're away from suffering, then we can develop the mind. And when we develop the mind, it's luminous. So all these things go together. And then, you know, then it's a matter of just, that's the point where we start to actually be, you know, where we're a Dharma warrior and we can actually start working it, pulling up the defilements by the root and leaving them at the door. So I think it's time for our meditation. Okay, just start by getting in a comfortable position. Upright but relaxed. Brighten the heart. Relax the toes and the feet, ankles, the lower legs, the knees, the thighs, the hips, hip bones, the waist, the lower half of the body. Just let it dissolve into peace and relaxation. Good enough. Relax the lower back and the belly. Just see if you can be aware of the belly rising and falling with the in-breath and the out-breath. coming into the present, putting down the past, the future, proliferation, just this simple awareness, the rising and falling of the belly with the breath. Relax the solar plexus, diaphragm, middle back, moving up to the upper back, shoulder blades, shoulders, collarbone, and the upper chest, and the heart. Letting go of any tension in the heart. Bright light, relaxing the heart, and become aware of the lungs, filling with an in-breath, emptying with an out-breath. You can see the breath with the mind, filling up and emptying. Nowhere to go. Nothing to do, content to be here right now. Relax the shoulders, the upper arms, elbows, lower arms, wrists, palms of the hands, the backs of the hands, and the fingers and fingertips. Relax the neck, inside out, chin, around the mouth, the cheeks and cheekbones, around the nostrils, the nose, around the eyes. Just let the eyes soften and relax. So much tension held in the eyes. Just allow the eyes to relax fully and deeply. Letting go of any anxiety, tension, worry, restlessness, or proliferation. The eyes relax completely. Like a soft smile, relaxation. The eyebrows and the forehead and the temples, the whole head, the whole body. With the body relaxed and the eyes relaxed, now we look at the mind, this experience arising right now. Just see the tendency for the mind to go outside. Like a hand trying to reach out and pick things up. The tendency of the mind flowing out into the world. And we just give up that tendency. Okay to be peaceful right now. Okay to give up the world. Just let the mind relax, saturated with peace. And There's no right or wrong in meditation. We're practicing and doing our best. It's good enough. So whatever happens in this meditation, accept it as it is without judgment. Now is the time. If we have a meditation object, to pick it up. Otherwise, I will give a guided meditation for those who prefer. We'll do a guided breath meditation. Some people prefer to watch the tip of the nose, at the upper lip, at the heart, at the belly. Some people like to follow the flow of the breath. Some people like to suffuse their whole experience. We just choose an object suitable to us, seems comfortable. I'm aware of a breath coming in. I'm aware of the breath going out. Like the feelings of the breath. We get inside the in-breath and the out-breath. The heart of friendliness. If you'd like a mantra, you can use Bud, the in-breath, Do, the out-breath, or Peace, Full. Particularly people who have a tendency to think it's useful to use a mantra. Fix our intention on the present with this soft awareness. Breath is the present moment. The out breath is the present moment. Nowhere to go, nothing to do. Content to be here right now. Giving up restlessness, irritation, doubt, drowsiness. Just being with the whole of the in-breath, the whole of the out-breath. Thank you. peaceful. Tranquil, serene. Upright position. Sense of luminosity and ease, suffusing the in-breath with peace, suffusing the out-breath with peace. Like a sun in our heart, not a care in the world. If we ever find the mind goes off, you just gently let go and return to the nest, like a bird snug in the nest. Return to our meditation object. A total commitment to being with the in-breath. Total commitment to being with the out-breath. See, with peace comes a subtle sense of enjoyment. thoughts and emotions, all just bubbles and mirages. Just come back to the breath. Like a bird snug in the nest. Heart of joy, light and ease. Buddha. Infusing the breath with a joyful ease of letting go, joy of being here right now. Buddha. Center on unshakable peace, unmovable ease and peace. friendliness. With this peace, this light of consciousness, present awareness of the in-breath and out-breath, we just see how the mind is after a period of meditation. See what the causes were, what the effect was, what's worked. Is it the posture, the meditation object? The feeling, the visual aspect. So we can learn how we meditate. It becomes a tool. The metta. And share this metta with ourselves. May we be happy and free from suffering. May those in this room be happy and free from suffering. May those on this property, the kangaroos, the birds, the devas, the insects, may we all be happy and free from suffering. Those in Perth, in Western Australia, may we all be happy and free from suffering. And the whole world, solar system, galaxy, universe, the ambrosial, three realms of existence, above, below, and all around, seen and unseen, near and far, lofty and low, may all beings be happy and free from all forms of difficulty and suffering. May they have this light and ease in their heart. we take this peace and kindness with us into our lives. That's the end of the meditation. We have a little chat. Now let us chant the verses of sharing in aspiration. Through the goodness that arises from my practice, may my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all virtuous leaders of the world, may the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth,
and the Lord of death,
may those who are friendly, indifferent or hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of my life. May they soon attain the threefold bliss and realize the deathless. Through the goodness that arises from my practice, and through this act of sharing, may all desires and attachments quickly cease, and all harmful states of mind,
until I
realize Nirvana in every kind of birth. May I have an upright mind, with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge, unsurpassed is the protection of the Dharma. The solitary Buddha is my noble Lord, the Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all these, may darkness and delusion be dispelled. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let's see. Samithya vivajantu saparoko vinasatu mate pavan tvantarayo suki dikayuko pava apiva tanasilisa nichang utapachahino chataro dhamma vatanti ayuvano sukhang palang pavatu sabha mangalang rakkantu sabha devata sabha bhuta nupavena sada suti bhavantu te pavatu sabha mangalang rakkantu sabha devata sabha dhamma nupavena sada suti bhavantu te bhavatu sabha mangalang rakkantu sabha devata sabha sangha nupavena sada suti bhavantu te. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.